welcome to episode 30 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
And I am Ashley Lynch.
We took a week off to catch up on movies. Well, you were caught up, but I thought that we would wait a little while longer, and I was away as well. But we thought
I caught up even more is what happened.
This is exactly it. And it gave us the opportunity to catch up with some new releases. Because, I mean, not a lot of stuff came out last week, but there were, or I guess 2 weeks ago, but there was a lot that came out this past Friday. So we can talk about some very fresh content. But before we get into the discussion, where can people find you?
Best place to find me is on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And same here, you can find me on Twitter at The Marina. So, but let's jump right into the conversation because there is a lot to talk about. And I wanted to start by talking about a movie that you saw that I have been trying to watch since I got back from my camping trip. And the timing just did not work out. So I'm going to go Monday night. Talk to me about Alex Garland's Men, because this movie looks so good.
Yes, I'm going to try to talk about this movie, because it is a very difficult movie to describe, and even doubly so after you've watched it. It's one of those movies that you're going to come out of the theater going, what did I just watch? And then you're going to spend the next, like, week thinking about this movie. And you'll land on some ideas about what it's actually getting at. But I think it's a really interesting film. I mean, the base premise is basically the lead character, played by Jessie Buckley, has basically just lost her husband, who killed himself. And she heads out to a remote villa in the middle of the, I think it's like Scottish or English countryside, to just hang out and sort of like, you know, get a hold of herself sort of thing. Try to get some normalcy back into her life and have a little bit of a vacation and a rest. And what she encounters is an increasingly bizarre series of encounters with random men in the area that starts to, by the end of it, you know, basically goes into like full-blown supernatural. And it all basically ties into the idea that like all these various manifestations that she's encountering are different like aspects of toxic masculinity, and not in a way that we typically see depicted on film as being toxic masculinity, which is usually just violence. And it all stems from this incident of her husband killing himself, and the reason he killed himself is they were getting divorced, and he tried to guilt her into not divorcing him by saying that if she divorced him, he would kill himself. And then he sort of follows through on that promise. And it becomes about like the emotional blackmail and the emotional toxicity that he puts on her to basically carry his emotional baggage, essentially, that he is incapable of doing. And the various ways in which men will affect women's lives with specific outlooks plays into the whole thing. And so it ends up being her alone in this remote villa and with various bizarre incidences occurring all the way up to the ending where it just goes fucking batshit off the rails crazy, and you will see things that you cannot unsee. You will see them for the rest of your life. It's some truly bizarre imagery. I can't really say too much more without like fully spoiling it, but at the same time I'm not sure it's a film that can be spoiled. Like I say, it's just like it is an inexplicable film that is more felt than it is described, and I really dug it. I thought it was super interesting. I think Alex Garland made an incredibly unique film that has some really kind of interesting stylistic choices that are in here. Like, one of the things that is most memorable to me is there's this point where she finds this this tunnel on her walk out in the woods, and she goes into the tunnel and she just starts like singing various notes and hearing the echo reverberating in this tunnel, and she starts to compound them to the point where, having sung various notes and hearing them bounce around, she has created a kind of symphony by herself. And it's this interesting little moment. And then that actually becomes a musical motif for the rest of the film, where you hear that as being basically the score of the film. And it's kind of alarming how well it works and how interesting it is. And what a unique voice it gives the film. So I think if you're interested in something that's like a little bit more on the bizarre side and is very much, it's very much a slow burn film, and something that is kind of inexplicable and will leave you kind of feeling more confused than having answers, this is the film for you.
I really like Alex Garland, and you've kind of nailed it. He makes these movies that are very, they're not, he's very assured. He came out of the gate with a vision, and he's been lucky enough to make the films that he wants to make, even if they're strange and bizarre and people don't understand them. And regardless of whether you like them or not, if you've given yourself into seeing an Alex Garland movie, the chances are you're always going to remember it, be whichever one it might be.
I think one of the things about Alex Garland, and it's always been like a little bit, I don't want to say hit or miss, but something that I've been a little bit cold on is he has a very specific kind of style, at least with his directing, where there's a certain amount of intellectualizing that happens in his films, which is perfectly fine because he's usually, you know, poking into topics that aren't regularly poked into, and it's really interesting. But also, he seems to prefer having everything be incredibly slowly paced, methodically slowly paced, like it's a freaking metronome you're watching his films. Like, the pace never deviates. It never ramps up or slows down. It's just like slow moving. You know, that's his style. And then also have the characters be incredibly muted too. Everyone's talking in low, hushed terms, and no one's really expressing themselves too massively, you know. And it's like that's just kind of like his aesthetic. That's what he likes. And in some places that works, in some places it doesn't. Like, trying to watch Devs, it kind of drove me nuts, and I just could not get into that show. And it was mostly because of the tone that he created in that show. But here, I think it works really well. I think it's definitely playing to that strength in men.
Yeah, I really, really like Devs a lot. I think I'm more in tune to Alex Garland than maybe you are, but generally speaking, I'm a big fan of his films, so I was still a bit disappointed that I haven't gotten around to see this yet, but I will fix it. I'm fixing it on Monday before it disappears in theaters altogether, because I know it's going to happen sooner rather than later.
It is going to be pushed out by the danger zone.
Oh, God. I'm surprised it hasn't already. And speaking of the danger zone, this is the big thing that I went to see on Saturday. This was our big event movie that we've been waiting for, I don't even know, like 2 years. At this point, I've forgotten when Top Gun Maverick was supposed to come out. But it's finally
come out. I think it was a year ago or something like that.
Okay, that makes sense. I do have like a 3D print that Dan did for me a couple of years back, basically as soon as he got his new printer. And it did have the date on it, but when the movie kept getting pushed back, we just cut the date right off. So now it's just the two jets. But so, I mean, I don't know what there is to say about Top Gun Maverick other than it's a lot of fun. It's very well made, very aptly made, clearly. It's going to make all of the money, and that's totally fine. And, you know, Tom Cruise is one of the few, if maybe not the last, quote-unquote movie star left that can still open a movie at $150 million on his name alone. Mm-hmm. There's very few other, if any, actors that can do this. I don't know if that's good or bad. The movie is not, like, one of the things that we were talking about is, like, Tony Scott's Top Gun is, it's kind of genius. I mean, I've seen that movie so many times at this point that every time I put it in, I'm like, why am I watching this again? It makes me feel happy. It's just this totally over the top, completely, the movie is so gay. Like, you couldn't make a movie. It's so good. It's so good. But I mean, it's so like sharp and fast paced, and the dialogue is really like it whip smart. And I mean, maybe it's also the fact that, you know, that movie is now like 30 some odd years old. So the chances are you've seen it 100 million times. And so the dialogue sticks with you. But watching the new Top Gun, the thing that surprised me was, one, I can't believe it took 3 or 4 writers to come up with, one, this story, and two, the script that has maybe one, maybe two memorable lines in it that we may be quoting in 10 years, but I highly doubt even that. And it just kind of feels, I hate to say it, but bland. Like, it's just a very, like, you get the jets, the action is all there, but it has all of these story points that just feel totally mute and just kind of boring. Like, just give me more jet action. That's all I'm here for anyways. So, you know, just give me more of that. I don't know. We really enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed it. Tom Cruise is great. Everybody else is kind of just there.
I've been on the fence about this one because I've heard like so many people talk about how great it is. But at the same time, I also feel like it almost feels like it needs to come with a disclaimer because the original Top Gun is so beloved by people. So it feels like a lot of these, oh my God, this is like the most incredible film I've seen in like 5 years. And I have seen people saying that this is basically carrying the baggage of their love for the original film. And as regular listeners might remember, I still have never seen Top Gun. I have not watched it. I managed to avoid it in my childhood. And I think it's because it's like, I grew up with it being that boy shooty airplane military movie, and I had no interest in that sort of thing. And then with years past, you know, passing by, like, I have seen Hot Shots, and so it feels like I've seen Top Gun, and I've seen enough references and other clips of the movie all throughout, you know, just my life absorbing it by osmosis, that I feel like I've seen the movie at this point. I don't feel like there's anything that I would get from going back and watching the movie. And honestly, I'm just not interested. And so I've constantly, like, with trying to temper the praise that people have had for this sequel with how much I already don't care about Top Gun. And I'm like, maybe I should just go see a fun action movie in the theater, because if you're going to see this movie in the theater, seems like the right place to see it. So you have like that big spectacle. It's going to be a spectacle movie. At the same time, it's Top Gun and I don't care. So I'm like, I'm so on the fence about this thing, and I don't know if I'm actually going to go see it or not.
I mean, I do think that, I don't think it's the best thing we've seen in 5 years. I think visually it is a spectacle. Probably on the same level and the same way that Mission Impossible 6 was a spectacle. Like, it has, like, the technicality of the effects and the visual and practical effects and just the way that the film is shot is really impressive. Like, it looks amazing. Well, the conversation that I had with my partner the other day was, you know, this morning, actually, we were talking about it. It's like, the thing that's really impressive is, yes, Top Gun Maverick looks amazing. And it does. It looks seamless. But I mean, technology is what it is. What's more interesting is that Top Gun was made 30 some odd years ago, and it too looks fucking amazing, which is even more impressive because they didn't have cameras that you could put on a dash of a plane and take it up into the air and actually do the scenes practically. So the fact that Tony Scott managed to make the original look as good as it does, and it still does, the 4K transfer is so good and the sound is so amazing, it's just mind-blowing. But I mean, I really liked Top Gun Maverick. I thought it was a lot of fun. The story is, at this point, completely inconsequential. Who the fuck cares? It's just like giant jets in the sky doing cool stuff. And you kind of sit there. We saw it in IMAX, which was kind of the only way that I was prepared to see it, because I wanted to like feel the rumblings of the airplanes all around me, and it was completely successful. It's like big spectacle movie. It was a lot of fun. I really liked it. I'd say if you're interested in the action, it's worth seeing on the big screen because it is super impressive. Like the visuals, it's very, very well made. Which brings me to the point that at this point, it's clearly the Tom Cruise show, because he works with Christopher McQuarrie on the Mission Impossible movies. He's now made a couple of movies with Joseph Kaczynski, and the visual style of the action between Mission Impossible and Top Gun is almost the same. This is clearly the Tom Cruise factor, because there's no way two directors that have had the careers that they've had where their movies look quite different, especially Kaczynski, would make a movie that looks so similar. But besides the point, it's fun. It is a lot of cheesy fun. There are a lot of callbacks to the original. Some work better than others. Most are really, really terrible. But generally speaking, it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Well, with Kaczynski, I think the interesting thing is, like, this is finally a film he's directing where he did not write it. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but he wrote Tron Legacy and he wrote Oblivion. And those two more feel like art design mood pieces than they do feel like films. And I don't particularly like either movie, but I think they look very pretty.
I'm not a huge Tron fan, but I really like Oblivion. But you're totally right. His films are far more like visual and kind of like a let yourself be taken by it. Because, I mean, you think about both of those, and the music in both of those films is so powerful and the visuals are so powerful that it kind of overstates the story, for sure.
Yeah, and I think he's probably in a better place when he is directing stuff that other people wrote.
So I'll say this, final word. If you're even vaguely curious, you're into the action, worth seeing. It's good. All
right, maybe I'll go see it while it's still on IMAX.
I would highly recommend it.
Hear the excitement in my voice.
Well, I tell you what,
fine, I'll go see Top Gun.
If you decide to go see it at IMAX, I will go again.
Okay.
I would take another stab at it.
We could talk about that.
Before we go on, I want to mention another movie that I've watched that's a, sort of a new release, so I want to kind of put it at the beginning of the show. It actually opens this Friday, June 3rd. I had a chance to see David Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future.
Oh, man.
So, the story here is interesting. So, the film is kind of like, it takes place in this near future where humanity has evolved to not feel pain. So the response to that is, for whatever reason, people have started doing these art pieces where they're basically like, they get sexual pleasure basically from hurting themselves and hurting others. So it's turned into this whole thing, this whole scene. Viggo Mortensen and Lea Seydoux play a pair of artists, performance artists, that work together doing these show pieces. The interesting thing with Viggo Mortensen's character is that he is actively growing new organs on a regular basis. And instead of leaving them in his body to do whatever it is that they're growing to do, he's having them removed as part of this art show. It all fits into this whole greater or larger piece where, you know, humanity is kind of evolving at this really fast rate, and when are we no longer going to be humans? And there's these two sort of warring factions of people, those that kind of want to stick to this idea of like humanity as it is now, and others that want to see where evolution is taking the human body. So that's kind of like the basic premise. Into this are Don McKellar being ridiculous, and Kristen Stewart, who play these government officials that are part of a new part of the police force that is like collecting and cataloging new body parts or new organs that are being created or grown. The whole thing is like a big clusterfuck of a story plot. You don't really need to know what the hell's happening, other than it's not nearly as gruesome or gross as David Cronenberg's previous body horror movies. So, I mean, it's a little bit shocking, but it's very tame in the canon of David Cronenberg, which I thought was really interesting. I thought it was a really fascinating sort of observation on our current kind of take, our culture's current obsession with sharing everything. Like, things have to be publicized, everything needs to, it's like social media. This universe that he's kind of created reminded me a lot about this idea, this concept of, you know, if you're not sharing it, it never really happened. So I don't know, there's some interesting things happening overall. I thought I really enjoyed it, but I thought it was kind of convoluted mess in other places. Like, there's certain storylines that just don't make any sense. And it's David Cronenberg. It's, you know, you're either going to enjoy it or you're not. It's not going to be for everyone. But it's nowhere near as gruesome as his previous movies.
I feel like with a movie like this, it's almost like you need to sort of, like, place it, like, in comparison to Videodrome or Existence. Because it really, from what I've seen, it really looks like it's of a type, yes, of those films.
Pretty much, I would say that Existence is probably the closer of the two. And it's not, I mean, and a lot of the sort of the tech that he uses in this movie is of that. It's very, very similar, like the design of the probes, some of the design. I'm assuming it's the same art designer that did the art for both, because the concept design is very, very similar to Existence. But it's, the movie is much tamer, I would say, than Existence. Completely randomly, and I mean, it would be easy enough to find, you just have to IMDb it, but chances are most people aren't going to scroll down to the bottom of David Cronenberg's list of filmography. However, we randomly, after the screening, went to the Black Dog video sale, sad face, and I was cruising the Canadian film shelf, and I picked up Fast Company, which is an early Cronenberg movie from, like,
his first movie.
Actually not. No. It might be his first. It's technically his third. On the disc, this is the only reason I know this. On the disc, I was kind of looking at it. I wasn't going to buy it because I thought, oh, it's a little overpriced. I look at the disc and it includes as a bonus feature on disc two, David Cronenberg's first two feature films, one of which is Crimes of the Future. Which was his which was his second film. So he made two movies before Fast Company. They're barely features. The first one is like an hour and 3 minutes long, and Crimes of the Future is an hour and 5 minutes long. So they're barely films. That said, I'm like, okay, well, now I have to buy it. Like, what are the chances, right? So he has taken this concept from this really terrible second movie that he made. I'm warning you, it's bad. It's not worth your hour time commitment. It's really bizarre. The whole thing is done in voiceover. It barely makes any sense. It doesn't even look great. It's just a weird little experimental movie. It's definitely a student film. But he's taken this very small concept from one scene of the movie where one of the characters is literally growing organs that they're then removing and storing and cataloging. And he's expanded it into the new Crimes of the Future. So I thought it was worth mentioning just because it's such a curio.
That's interesting.
So yeah, there we go.
Reaching back to the very beginning of his career.
Yeah, Crimes of the Future is technically Crimes of the Past. So yeah, I mean, I guess my final thought on Crimes of the Future is, it's worth a look if you're a hardcore David Cronenberg fan. But beyond that, I find it really difficult to recommend. I don't think, it just doesn't have the staying power of some of his other stuff, like, you know, Existence or even Crash at this point, which still plays really, really well, I think. But
I mean, fortunately for me, I am a hardcore David Cronenberg fan, so
worth a look.
But I don't know. We'll see. Some of his stuff I bounce off of and some of it I don't.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. So let's talk about Morbius, which is something we have both seen. Shocker.
Talk about Morbius. Oh, my God. I don't feel like I need to set up Morbius at this point. Everyone knows what Morbius is. Morbius is the Marvel, not Marvel movie. It is Sony holding on for dear life to all the Spider-Man rights that they own, and they have decided to go in whole hog on making as many obscure Spider-Man villain movies as possible. We've got a Kraven the Hunter movie coming out in the near future, and then they've also announced another movie where Bad Bunny is going to be playing, I think, a Mexican wrestler character. I can't remember. But anyways, Morbius is basically next in that list. It's like, well, Venom works, so let's make Morbius. And I think everyone had a resounding why. Who's asking for this movie? And I guess enough people, because it actually made money. People went to go see it. And I think a lot of people went to go see it to kind of like scoff at the train wreck. And I'd be lying if I said that wasn't part of the reason why I eventually watched it. I did not watch it in the theater. I watched it at home. And the movie itself, honestly, it's not so much a train wreck. It's just boring. It's not fun bad. It's just boring bad. And honestly, there's nothing like horribly offensive or awful about this movie. It's just very bland. I think the thing that I found the most disappointing, though, was I got like 30 minutes into this movie and I realized, wait a minute, there's actually a legitimately good movie here, but they're never going to make that movie. And if they had leaned into it being a horror and basically just remade The Fly, but done it with Morbius, I think it would have been legitimately good. But that's not the movie that Sony's interested in making. They're just going to recycle the superhero formula for this. And as it is, it's just like, meh, it's there, it exists. I saw things that I instantly forgot. That's Morbius.
I think the funny thing here is that, let's be honest, Jared Leto is no Tom Hardy. So this was never going to be on the level of Venom. That said, I waited because I heard of all the stink on this. And I was like, you know what? I don't really need to watch a bad movie. And then I saw a GIF of Matt Smith dancing in that thing. And I was like, okay, give me Morbius. I want to see this now.
He does a lot of dancing in the movie.
Yes. And that is quite literally, I'm not even joking, that is pretty much the only reason I decided to even watch this. And I like vampire movies. So, you know, I was kind of like, okay, sure. And I'm with you. I don't think there was anything that was like horribly terrible here, other than the fact that Jared Leto takes himself far too seriously and he needs to like chill for a minute, because he and Matt Smith were clearly in different movies. Mm-hmm. And that was probably one of the most disappointing bits about it, is that they really did feel like they were in totally different universes even. That said, there are some scenes that really, really impressed me. Like some of the visual design I thought was really great. And there is a subway scene that I actually rewound and watched twice because I thought it was so well done. Like, it starts as they're coming down the stairs, and at one point, one of them bounces off the wall, and they have this cool effect where, like, when they're in, I guess, super villain mode, or
anti-hero. Let's call it Morbin mode.
Oh, that's so bad, but okay. When they're in Morbin mode, they have this cool, like, smoke effect that I actually thought was a cool little visual thing. So, I mean, I like the way it looks. I just, there's so little to really like bite into. Oh, that was so bad. I'm so bad. Sorry. I kind of didn't know I was going there until it happened. So, I don't know. I didn't hate it. I don't regret seeing it. I just, it's mostly disappointing because, like you say, there is material here that suggests this could have been, or there is a great movie to be told from this story, but nobody's ever going to make it. At least none of the big studios that have the cachet or own the rights to make it.
Yeah.
So that's disappointing.
And I think it is interesting to go back and take a look at Venom and what Tom Hardy did in that, because clearly there's the movie Sony wanted to make with Venom, and then there was the movie that Tom Hardy was willing to deliver. And for whatever reason, Tom Hardy was able to insert enough lunacy in his performance into the first Venom that it kind of shone through. And that was what everyone connected with in the film, not the movie that Sony wanted to make. So much so that when it came time to do the Venom sequel, Tom Hardy was able to get writing credit, and they were able to sort of take control of that and steer the tone where they wanted to, which is more looniness. And as a result, like, Venom 2 was on my top 10 movies of the year last year because it is so much fun. And Morbius is very much the movie that Sony wanted Venom to be. And Jared Leto, even though I think he actually makes a good Morbius, I think he's good casting for this role, he is not willing to do what Tom Hardy did in Venom. He's playing it very straight, and he's taking it seriously. And he plays it well. Like, as much as I don't like Jared Leto as a person, he's a good actor. And I think he's actually doing genuinely good work in this movie, which is an ostensibly really silly, goofy, stupid movie. But if he were willing to go the Tom Hardy route and just, like, play up the camp of it a bit more, not even camp, just, like, play into the goofiness of it and create something that's, like, larger than the stupidity of the film itself, he could have his own Venom, but he's not willing to do that because you said it before, and I can't get away from it, just the fact that it seems like he's taking himself way too seriously, you know, and it's to the film's detriment.
Agree. And I think my personal feeling is that Matt Smith actually went in that direction, and the movie would have been better if Leto had also gone there. But it is what it is. I mean, I will say the opening and closing credit sequences are really awesome. I don't know if that's, like, enough to sell a movie, but I do love them. They're really, really great. Oh,
although the post-credit sequence for this is one of the stupidest fucking things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Okay, so we turned it off. I didn't get to see the post-credit sequence, so that's okay.
I'm just going to spoil it for everyone. Okay, so if you care, just, like, close your ears for, like, 10 minutes or not 10 minutes, like 2 minutes. It's not going to take me that long. There's two post-credit sequences. One is basically they just multiverse Michael Keaton's Vulture into this universe. He just, like, magically appears in his jail cell, and everyone's like, where'd this guy come from? And so he gets, like, released on his own recognizance because they don't know who this guy is or what he's doing in this universe. And then there's another post-credit sequence where basically the Vulture in full Vulture gear flies up to Morbius and says, hey, I think we should team up and do some stuff. And Morbius is like, that sounds interesting. And it's some of the worst ADR work I've ever heard, where they've got, like, a guy in a suit who's, like, pantomiming, and then Michael Keaton, who's very clearly in a booth, just it sounds like they said, hey, Mike, go out to your car and record some lines on your phone. We'll make it work. And I've never heard ADR match so badly in a movie in my life.
Okay, that's hilarious.
I hated everything about those post-credit scenes. All of it. I hated all of it.
I still can't believe I missed. I didn't even think to watch through the credits.
Those post-credit scenes are the train wreck you hoped Morbius was.
Oh, God almighty. Oh. All right, let's talk about something that, well, I enjoyed more. I don't know if you enjoyed more, but let's talk about Sputnik.
Sputnik. I actually just watched this last night. This is a 2020 Russian movie, which is basically a sci-fi horror film about Sputnik astronauts that crash back to Earth. And basically one of them has infected is not the right word. He has basically like an alien that's inhabiting his body now. And basically at night it comes out of his body. And there's a doctor who, a disgraced doctor who is basically brought in to essentially examine him and try to figure out how to separate this alien from the astronaut, because they're kind of living a completely like symbiotic host parasite relationship at this point where they can't really be separated. And so she's brought in to try to figure out how to like separate the alien from the astronaut. And it goes in some really interesting places. I think the best way to describe this film is it's kind of like, what if Arrival, but a horror movie? Because it sort of has that tone where it starts off right off the bat from kind of like a scientific research perspective with the surrounding of a military apparatus. And in this case, it is like the USSR. And so while they're sort of encompassing this entire thing around real world event, it's about Sputnik, basically, and inserting aliens into that. It's like, well, then how come I've never heard about it? Well, because it's from behind the Iron Curtain. Like, how long did they keep Chernobyl shit under wraps that we did not know about? So I think it's kind of a conceit that works really well. And the film, I think, goes in some really interesting places. It's very well performed, very well shot. The creature itself, I think, looks fantastic. The effects are, like, really well done. And I think the design of the creature looks really good. And, oh my god, the score for this film, especially the score, I thought was absolutely transcendently amazing. I was absolutely captivated by the audio for this film. I think it's definitely worth watching. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I highly recommend it as well. It was a movie that I really liked when I saw it shortly after it came out. I can't remember, maybe sometime last year at this point, because I didn't watch it during its festival run. But I was also really, really impressed by the alien design. I thought it was so unique and unlike anything we'd seen before, which I thought was really interesting, because at this point we've seen so many alien movies. They all kind of look the same, or they kind of look like each other.
And it's hard to come up with a new original design.
Yeah. And I thought this was actually a really, really well designed creature that didn't really look like anything we'd seen before. And I'm with you. I would say that if you haven't seen it and you like I don't want to say slow burn, but it is kind of a slow burn horror movie. This is definitely one to check out. It's tops. Really, really well done. Really, really well done. To change the pace and the mood a little bit, The Lost City by Aaron and Adam Nee with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. This ridiculousness of a movie.
Yeah, so, I mean, the best way to describe this movie is it's Romancing the Stone 2. It's basically just a remake of Romancing the Stone. It's a romance novel author goes off on a jungle adventure. And I guess the difference is that, like, she doesn't meet, like, the real-life version of the cover bottle on her books. But rather, like, she goes on the adventure with the guy who poses as the model on, basically a himbo played by Channing Tatum, who is, like, completely ill-equipped for adventure, but wants to be that guy so desperately. And she is just, like, completely jaded and, like, done with fucking everything. The movie looked like it was going to be really fun. It's like, okay, I can get on this wavelength. I'm down for, like, another Romancing the Stone movie, no matter, like, how much of a, you know, just, like, bald-faced, you know, repeat it seems like. Channing Tatum and Sandra Bullock. It's like, okay, I'm down. The movie's just boring.
It moves for a movie that should be a lot more fun. It does feel very bland.
It's... it reminded me of a lot of the movies that we'd get in, like, the 90s, where they'd pair a couple stars together and just, like, put them in, like, a fun, you know, sort of, like, caper-type film, and they're so forgettable. Like, I'm thinking of, like, movies like I Love Trouble with Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte. Like, when's the last time you thought about that movie? Never. Chances are you've never even seen that movie, or possibly never even heard of it. But that was at one point poised to be, like, a big summer release for the studio that year that, like, no one went to go see. And this very much feels like that movie. If this movie came out in the 90s, it would feel right at home, and it would be, like, of its ilk of that kind. And it's like, there's nothing here that's offensively bad, but there's also nothing here that's, like, really great. All the most entertaining moments are in the trailer, and it's just, there's not a lot here.
The best moments begin and end when Brad Pitt shows up and then dies.
Yes.
Let's be honest. At that point, it was like, oh, okay, well, this is no longer fun.
Yeah. And they put a lot of Brad Pitt in the trailer. They leaned on that because they knew that stuff was working. And that's the problem. There's not enough stuff in this film that works.
Yeah.
So, it feels very much like it's going through the motions.
Oh, it does. It does. And even that final kiss just feels kind of like bland. I'm like, there's no passion here. But, you know, it was an okay romp. I always like Sandra Bullock.
Let me put it this way. As I was going through the list of movies for us to talk about today, I had to remind myself that I actually watched this movie because I'd already forgotten about it. It's only been 2 weeks.
Okay, well, the next one that's on your list is How I Feel. Firestarter.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. I'm like, oh, wait, I saw that too.
Yeah, so this is Firestarter is the most recent remake of a straight up adaptation of Stephen King's novel, but kind of like a remake of the 80s film, which was also an adaptation of that novel. But a young girl who's basically a pyrotechnic and create fire from nothing, and, you know, is basically like on the run with her father. And it's boring. It's a very dull movie.
It is.
There's not a lot here. I mean, you have Zac Efron playing a father, which is weird.
He takes his shirt off, and I was like, why did no one warn me? And then that was pretty much the highlight of the movie.
And he's fine, but everybody, I don't know. Everybody is kind of fine. Yeah, I was just thoroughly bored by this movie. I was not entertained. I was not thrilled. There's nothing exciting happening, even though it seems like there's a lot of exciting stuff that should be happening. It's just, I don't know. Maybe it's I've never read King's original Firestarter story. So maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's just like such a lesser work of his that there's not much here to create a good adaptation out of, but I don't know. I did not enjoy this film at all. And I didn't hate it either, but it's just like halfway through, I was like, oh God, this movie better pick up at some point, and it never picks up.
We watched this on the same night that we watched the Scream remake. I don't even know what they're calling it. I think it's just called Scream.
It's just called Scream.
It was the same. We had the same exact same reaction. I'm like, this is the lamest night of horror movies ever. Or wannabe horror movies. I don't even know. It was a very lame evening, and I felt really bad that I made everybody sit through both of them. The Boys from County Hell.
Yeah. This is another one I just watched the other day. It's on Shudder. It's a 2020 film. And it's basically an Irish vampire movie. And it's basically a small town, few ne'er-do-wells that are, you know, working construction in this Irish town. And the town is kind of known for, I believe it's where Bram Stoker originally came from or conceived of or wrote Dracula, something like that. But the town is basically like, that's his sole claim to fame, and how they attract tourists is like, you know, birthplace of Dracula sort of thing. And in the construction of of the this field that they're clearing, they clear this old cairn, this pile of rocks, and it basically like lets loose this old ancient vampire, which you could call Dracula, but they kind of scoff at the idea of like as Dracula. But it's like this ancient vampire comes out and starts feeding on people. And it's there's a few interesting kind of twists in there, because the vampire will not just like suck blood out of people and like create vampires, but it like literally sucks blood out of people in the way that like people will just start like it'll get near and people start gushing blood from their noses and bleeding out their eyeballs, and the blood will start flowing to the vampire.
Okay, that's
and
cool.
So it's like, yeah, it's really neat, and I haven't seen that before. And it's good performances. It's shot really well. There's some good effect. I think the only problem I had with the film really is just that like it seems a little bit tonally confused, but not in a way that really felt like it was detrimental to the film. Like, it couldn't decide if it was going to be a straight-up horror movie, if it wanted to be Shaun of the Dead and, like, poke fun at itself. And it kind of does both. And it never not works because of that. But it did feel a little bit jarring the way it was, like, we're bouncing back and forth between tones quite regularly. But it's, I don't know, there's enough stuff here that's good and interesting and original take on a very a pretty well-worn genre, but at the same time not enough that I'm like, wow, that was absolutely amazing and refreshing. You know, it's like it just felt like a very solid film, and it's definitely worth a watch if that sounds at all intriguing to you. But it's also not an incredible film. It's just a really good solid double up the middle film.
Ah, sometimes that's all you need. I'm okay with that. I haven't been on
Shutter in a while. And it has accents, so, you know, it makes it feel exotic.
I love it.
And there's a point at the very beginning where they basically scam some Canadian tourists.
Okay, that's winning right there. Winning at life. Scam the Canadians. What the hell, man? Okay, let's talk about some TV. And I haven't seen a whole lot because I've been head down and busy with other stuff. But you've got at least one on your list that I'm really, really curious about. We've set our PVR because we don't get the channel that it's on. So we're going to be watching it when it premieres on Showtime, on Showcase. But Angeline.
Yeah, this is a mini series that's on Peacock, or as we like to call it, the CAC. This is a doc series that is about Angeline, who is potentially maybe the first, or I don't know if you could call it the first, but person who's like famous for being famous, essentially. And she is the woman who, like, you've probably seen the big Angeline billboard that's up in Hollywood, that is basically just like it's a landmark of Hollywood at this point. This blonde bombshell woman named Angeline, it's like, who is that? You know, it's like, is she like a musician? Is she an actor? Where do I know this woman? And it's like, why does she have a whole billboard? And it's like, that's it, no one knows. And she's been incredibly secretive for most of her life about who she is and where she's come from. She's very much about just like creating iconography. And apparently she can be seen still today, like driving up and down the boulevard in her pink Corvette, like honking and waving at people. She's just like a mainstay. But I guess a while ago there was a reporter who basically did like a deep dive into who she actually is and wrote this big expose. It's like, here's the history of Angeline. Here's who she really is and where she came from and like the story of her life. And the doc series is based on that. And so it basically goes back to the beginning of her essentially starting to create a career, first in music and going from there. And it's told in a very kind of fun and cheeky way, where you're getting it from multiple perspectives. It's like filmed like it's a documentary. So even though this is true story stuff, everyone's all played by actors, but they're also giving like two camera interviews, like present day, and like it's a documentary. And then you're also getting a whole bunch of unreliable narrator stuff. So this character is giving you this version of events, and then we'll cut to Angeline and go, no, it didn't happen at all like this. This is what happened. And then you get, like, the different version. And so it plays a lot with the unreliableness of the history of everything in a way that's actually genuinely fun. And she's an interesting enough character, even if she is, like, a little bit grating, because she's very much like, ew, I'm a Barbie doll, you know, sort of thing. And it's grating at first, but the more time you spend with her, the more time you're like, this is kind of amazing. So it's really interesting. I'm looking forward to, it's only like 5 episodes. So it's not that big of a buy-in. And there's only 1 episode out so far, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the rest of it.
Awesome. Yeah, we're excited for that to start so we can get jumped in too, because it looks like a lot of fun. So Halo is over.
How was Halo?
Okay, so it's an odd number of episodes. It ends on 9 episodes. Not that there's like a written, fast and written rule now at this point about how long series are, but they tend to be either like 8 or 9 episode seasons when you're talking about like these TV, like these cable shows. This one is 9, which is a bit weird. So when they did episode 8, I started to have a panic attack because I was like, oh my God, they're going to leave us hanging. They're never going to be able to wrap this story up in 1 episode. We're going to get fucked. And then I discovered that actually they have already renewed the show for a 2nd season. I doubt that they will do more than 2 seasons. There is no way that we're going to get a season 3 out of this. So they better make good and resolve some shit in season 2. Because they certainly left me on a cliffhanger. And I think that Halo is this property that you can never win. You're never gonna satisfy the fans because they want something that you can't actually make a series or a movie about. The game is one thing and you're either into the game or you're not. And I find it hard when people are like, well, but the show doesn't. I mean, the show is the show. It's its own thing. I don't need to know anything about the video game in order to enjoy what they've created of this universe, because it's actually pretty interesting. It has some great visuals. It has great, I like the fact that it has like this whole history and storyline that I'm not familiar with. That's like, to me, totally new. It's like an interesting sci-fi project. And yes, I understand there's like all this other stuff that goes into the universe, but because I'm not familiar with it, I don't have the baggage to go with it. So I really enjoyed the show. Dan, on the other hand, hated it because he's like, well, we're how many games into it? We've still not seen what Master Chief looks like. Like, and I don't fucking care. Like, to me, that's besides the point. It's so not the interesting part of the movie, of the series. So I don't know. I don't think you can ever win with this. I personally thought that the series was really well done. Pablo Schreiber is really good in it. They've introduced a character who I have no idea if she's in the games or not. Her name is Kai. She's like one of the super soldiers, I guess. And they've given her a really interesting backstory as well. I don't know. Like, I'm hoping they're able to wrap the series in the next season, because they've kind of left it on a cliffhanger where they've now. Can I spoil this? Like, I don't even know if you can spoil this because I don't know what's in the game and what's not. There's the character in the show named Mackie, who is with the aliens, and they kind of developed her as kind of a love interest, and then they killed her in the final episode. And they've left this massive gaping hole where Master Chief is now taken off with these 2 artifacts that are supposed to locate the Halo, except he doesn't really know how they work, and we don't know what the Halo is. So I'm like, I have no idea. Where are you taking me for season 2? I don't think they're going to be able to answer everything. I thought it was great. I really, really like the show, but I don't know how to sell it to anybody. I really don't. I don't know how you can. I honestly don't know how you can.
I know what you mean about the kind of rift between, like, you have the game where you have, like, a certain amount of baggage, and then trying to make a show for those people is almost a fool's errand. And I think this is the problem with IP. Like, this is going to seem like a weird tangent, but there was that, what was it called? There was that movie that came out a little bit ago on Netflix, a vampire movie called Night Teeth, which I watched and I dug. I enjoyed it. It wasn't incredible, but I've had a really fun time with it. And as I got like 15 minutes into the movie, I'm like, wait a minute, this is just Vampire the Masquerade with the serial numbers filed off. And then about an hour through the movie, because I can't get this thought out of my head, I was thinking to myself, you know what? It's actually better to make the version of the thing with the serial numbers filed off, because if this were a Vampire the Masquerade, like, direct adaptation, they use the name, then suddenly you're sitting there watching going, well, that's not like the game, and that's not like the game, and here they're breaking the world there. You know, when really what you just want is you want them to tell you an enjoyable story. And when you're encumbered by also having to adhere to this pre-existing IP, you're locking yourself in a box in which you're never really going to please people. And I think that that almost becomes a detriment. I mean, it's kind of the world we're in right now because everything's IP-driven. So it's like the only reason the Halo show exists is because of the Halo game. You know, if it weren't for that, this show would just, they wouldn't make this show, you know, and just call it something else. So it's a double-edged sword.
It totally is. And I mean, the reality of it is that the universe was built for the game. The universe itself is what's interesting, and the story being told within that universe. And it is a really interesting universe. I mean, I tried playing the game. I lasted 10 minutes. It drove me mad. I'm like, this is so not for me. I could never spend any time in this universe. And it's not like, I'm sure there's a story that you can follow, but to me, it was like I was in a car going around trying to shoot people. I'm like, not interested. But the series itself, I thought, actually had, you know, character development and a story that was interesting in a world that was interesting. And a lot of it was, most of it was totally new to me. So I was kind of like trying to figure out, who are these characters? What is this world that we're talking about? And I thought it was really, really well put together. The fact that nobody's talking about it clearly indicates that nobody else watched it. So I'm just hoping, against all hope, that they actually make season two.
Well, and where is this?
I'm not convinced that they will.
Where is this playing again? Is this Apple TV?
This is Paramount Plus, which makes things even worse.
Yeah. And I think that might be part of the problem, too, because it's like, it feels like the only people who have Paramount Plus are the people who are interested in Star Trek. What else is their streaming content? I don't hear anything else about Paramount Plus. Oh,
they're knee-deep in, I've forgotten what it's called. Yellowstone.
Oh, okay.
Yellowstone is what essentially launched their entire platform.
Gotcha. That's the Taylor Sheridan series, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, yes, it's on Amazon Prime as well. But really, Paramount was even the regular Paramount channel, it's basically living and breathing on Yellowstone and the spinoffs. Mm-hmm. It's basically the Taylor Sheridan, like, channel, because he also has like another show on there that's totally unrelated to Yellowstone, but he's basically like the sole brain creator in that entire TV side. And it, you know, it seems to be working for them. Yellowstone is a really, really good show. So good for them. But I really liked Halo. I'm disappointed more people aren't talking about it. I also understand that it's not for everyone, but I thought it was great. Like, really good. And it's probably one of the best things that Jonathan Liebsman has made in a couple of years, I would say. Because I think he's one of the chief creators on that show. And he's certainly directed a number of episodes, maybe half of the series. So it certainly has a stamp on it. It's good. And it gets better as the episodes progress. The first episode I didn't think was particularly strong because it felt very much like a video game. But they really dig into the character development later into the season, and it's to the show's benefit. So I really, really liked it quite a bit. I was actually surprised to see this on your list because this doesn't strike me as something that you would be into. Goliath.
Yeah, no, I love this show. This is the fourth season of Goliath that dropped recently on Amazon Prime. For people who don't know, the show, it's basically it's kind of like a legal mystery thriller, I guess is the best way to describe it. But the entire premise is Billy Bob Thornton plays a lawyer who was like a big shot. I believe his prosecuting attorney had a big firm and would represent like horrible corporations and made a shitload of money and was a guy who had like an unprecedented track record in the court. And he was just like he you know, hence the title of the show. He was a freaking giant in the court and in the legal world. And then he just like completely burned out. He just like flamed out, went walkabout, became like a total drunk and disappeared. And that's where we kind of meet up with him at the beginning of the first season, where he basically gets sucked into representing a small client going up against his former legal partners in a big corporate lawsuit. And every season is basically this various like version of like the David and Goliath legal story, which is here's this one small person that the system is designed to crush, and the giant corporate legal entities that have all of the power to crush those little people, and in steps Billy Bob Thornton to potentially, you know, strike back at the big guys on behalf of the little guys. That's our premise. And in between there, we get what is essentially a mystery series because he seems to do more investigating than he does actual, like, legal work, even though it's all framed around the legal world. And it just, like, a fun kind of, like, pulpy noir mystery series. And each one is, like, very unique. And the show's also, I found incredibly interesting in that it feels like it gets like 2/3 of the way through the season, and I don't want to say it goes off the rails, but it starts to get batshit in various ways. It's almost like they start to get through their entire premise like 2/3 of the way through, and then it starts to like get like really weird in particular ways. This season is like a little bit more tonally consistent in the fact that they start being weird right off the bat. So it's like all the way throughout the season, but I think this season's a lot more kind of tempered with its weirdness. But like to just give you an idea, the second episode for the season opens with a big musical number of J.K. Simmons performing about the virtues of opioids. And so like this season is all about basically tackling the opioid epidemic. And J.K. Simmons is like the head of an opioid pharmaceutical manufacturer that Billy Bob Thornton is going up against. And it's, I don't know, it's really interesting. It's like, it's created by David E. Kelley, who just does nothing but legal shows. And it's gotten that sort of like interesting, sort of like legal but not legal take that he often does in his shows. Where it's like, okay, this is a world about lawyers, but also we're not going to spend a lot of time lawyering. And it's, I don't know, I really enjoy the show. I think it's fun, pulpy mystery, and then it, with a helping of, like, interpersonal drama that goes on, and, you know, every season has some interesting things to say about whatever particular industry, and they get some really good actors in these. Like last season, Dennis Quaid was the villain in the show. So it's like it attracts some really good talent for the show, and I'm digging it.
No, I was surprised to see like a legal drama in your watch list. It just didn't strike me as something that you might enjoy, but it sounds like it actually is more interesting than I give it credit for. So I may have to check this out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have slept on the show, and it's why I kind of like try to champion it a little bit. Like I think a lot of people say, oh, legal series with Billy Bob Thornton. I know exactly what that is. And it's like, I kind of guarantee that you don't know what this is. I don't know how else to describe it other than say just give it a couple episodes, and like I stepped into it very tepidly and I was very quickly hooked, and at this point like I'll watch the show for as long as it's on.
Nice. Okay. We may have to give this a go after I catch up with all the other stuff that I'm supposed to be watching that I haven't watched yet because I'm so behind.
I know, story of our lives at this point. Have you watched all 18 hours of Stranger Things Season 4 yet?
Wait, is that how long it is? We watched episode 1 last night.
I am only vaguely joking, but I think the episodes are verging on feature film length for the entirety of the season.
Yeah, because I noticed the episode 1 was an hour and almost 20 minutes, and somebody had commented that the last episodes were each like 90 minutes long. So I'm not surprised that it's like hugely
it's long. No longer a TV series, it's just a bunch of feature films.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about another Netflix show that dropped last week, Love, Death, and Robots. I really like this, the concept for this series. I think season two, now I haven't seen most of season three, I think season two was probably the weakest of the three so far. I know this is something that you've seen as well. Curious to get your take on it, but my general feeling is, holy shit, this season was amazing.
Yes. I am an unabashed fan of Love, Death, and Robots. I love the format. I love the style. I love what they're doing. This falls in this this subgenre that I've created on a list for on Letterboxd that I love, which is stuff that you could just call heavy metal and would be entirely accurate. This is heavy metal, the series. That's what Love, Death, and Robots is. And
it's what it was going to be originally. It was going to, David Fincher was going to make a heavy metal movie.
Is that true?
Okay. At some point he was slotted to make heavy metal the movie, and it fell apart for whatever reason. And instead they made this.
I mean, that totally tracks. But yeah, the show is created by David Fincher and Tim Miller, who is the head of Blur Studios. So there's, you know, Fincher's longtime VFX partner, but Tim Miller, who also went on to direct the first Deadpool movie and the Terminator Dark Fate movie. So he's like in the world of directing. But they created this show, and it's basically just a series of animated shorts that all sort of vaguely fit into the sci-fi fantasy genre in some sense, very broadly sort of defined and with no connection whatsoever. And it's a whole different series of writers and artists, and every short has kind of a different design style to it. There's no consistency, so you're going to get like a whole bunch of variety. If there's every episode ends up being like on average around 10 to 15 minutes because these are all animated shorts. And so if there's one that you're not jiving with, just go on to the next one, and maybe this one's going to be incredible. It's always a bit of a grab bag. And I love the concept of this thing. And even when there's one episode that just like, I'm like, okay, that was a little bit weak. I don't care. I still love it. I love that this exists. I want to continue to exist. I want season 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 of this thing. I want to, please make more. That is my note. Even when it doesn't work, please make more. And I agree with you. I think season 2 was probably some of the weaker stuff. Even though I did still like it, it's like, okay, well, this is fine. But season 3... I can't remember how many episodes there are in this season. It's like about 8 I want to say.
Nine episodes. There's nine.
There is not a single meh episode in this entire season. Every single episode is an all-timer. It is absolutely incredible, and I've just been ecstatic with what they have done this season. In particular, the last one, Jabaro, is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. It's directed by, I want to bring attention to it, Alberto Meago, who he also did the short from the first season, The Witness, and he was hired to basically do design work on Into the Spider-Verse. And he also did a short film advertisement for the game Watch Dogs Legion, which if you...
And he won... And he won an Oscar.
Yeah, he did the... What was it?
The
Windshield Wiper, which I have not seen, but I really want to see. And I don't know how it is he does this, but he's managed to capture motion in a way that I have never seen in animation ever before. Particularly with this one, it is kind of uncanny. Like, I had a friend trying to debate with me how much of it was animation, how much of it was live action. It's like, none of it's live action. It's all animation. It's all, like, mocap 3D animation. But the technique seems to be, like, or having basically like animated it at a high frame rate and then over cranking it so that everything like is moving a little bit faster, but it has this smoothness to it that you never see in animation. And it's really interesting. It's really unique, and it's absolutely arresting with how beautiful it is. It's I know I'm really diving into this one short quite a bit, but all the shorts are great. And like the other one I was very happy to see come back was a follow-up to the Three Robots short from the first season, which was one of my favorite shorts that I've gone back to and watched over and over again because I think it's so funny. And this one as well, I think, which is just as good, which is just like three quirky robots wandering the apocalypse after all the humans have died and trying to like make sense of the world that humans lived in.
Yeah, so that one is Patrick Osborne, and Netflix released that one on YouTube in its entirety a day or two before the series actually dropped on Netflix. So if you, for whatever reason, don't have Netflix, you can at least watch that episode. It is on the Netflix YouTube channel, and it is, like you say, very funny. And I think it's amazing that you also singled out Jimbaro because it was by far my favorite of the batch, and it is a really, really, for me, it's one of the strongest seasons. But that... the imagery in that short is just stupendous, and the mix, like the storytelling as well, like the entire concept of it and the sound design, the whole thing is just on another level. It is so, so good.
Yeah, it's so unlike good. Anything you've ever seen.
It is unlike anything you've ever seen. And I think it's also worth noting that because I had the opportunity to watch a couple of the shorts as part of like a package that they did where it was like the best of Love, Death, and Robots with a preview of season 3. And they had a couple of the new shorts mixed in with some of like the classics from seasons 1 and 2. And one of the ones that they played was... bad traveling, which I thought was really visually interesting when I saw it. And they didn't show you any of the credits. They just played one short into the next. And I didn't realize that one had actually been directed by David Fincher.
Yeah, this is his first, the first one that he's actually directed. He directed, Andrew Kevin Walker wrote the script for it, who of course wrote the script for 7 and has basically been like, ghostwriting on everything that Fincher has done since, but not enough to actually get credit until their next film, like the I think it's called The Killer, which is Fincher's next film, which Andrew Kevin Walker has credit for. And the lead actor, it's like, oh my god, who's the actor in this? Because this is so good, like the lead. And I look it up, and it is Troy Baker, of course, who is like a phenomenal voice actor who does a lot of video game work. And it is kind of funny because I just have a conversation with someone about how in the early days of games, when they started doing voice work, they bring in all these celebrities to, you know, these actors to do voices. And what they found out is that it's actually better to get people who specialize in just doing video game voiceover work. You get better performances out of that because actors like to have space and interact, and there's other people who have developed the skills to be able to do those types of voice as well. And exact same thing with, like, you take someone like Troy Baker and you put him in an animated movie like this, and he delivers an incredible performance. It's absolutely astounding. So it's like that one is a really good short too. Like I say, they're all bangers, but it's kind of wild that of the two that stuck in my mind, the David Fincher one was not my go-to immediately, even though that is a great short.
Yeah, no, the one that Jimbaro was it. Like, I saw that and I'm like, holy shit, this thing is killing.
I can't imagine how many hours went into that short.
I'm very curious to get some more insight into the making of that particular one. I love good making ofs. Worth noting for those that may not be aware, Netflix has never released an art book of Love, Death, and Robots, which is shocking. Oh, they should. It is coming. So there is a book coming for seasons 1, 2, and 3. It's coming out in June. I'll link to it in the show notes if you're at all curious about that. It's definitely probably something that you're going to want to pick up if you're into these things. But yeah, so that is coming.
I am looking it up and adding it to my order list because there's no way I'm not getting
hold off. Okay, hold off on that because we'll talk after and I'll give you some insight.
Okay.
But let's finish strong, I assume, with George Carlin's American Dream.
Yeah, so this is a two-part documentary that came out on HBO Max. And George Carlin is a comic who I've always enjoyed. I've always found him incredibly insightful and agreed with him a lot, even when he's at his most grumpiest and nihilistic. And I think as time goes on, even though George is no longer with us, I find myself agreeing with him more and more. And this is basically just a documentary about his life. And it looks like they'd started to work on this before his passing, because there's a lot of footage of basically interview, which looks like late in his life, which, you know, we've got some more George talking to us from beyond the grave, essentially, which is, you know, bittersweet, but nice to have more of that. And it's, I don't know, I think he led a really interesting life and came in at a really interesting time in comedy. And it goes through basically his ups and downs, of which he had many, where he sort of like came in as just needing to work and doing these variety shows and absolutely hating it. And then he broke away from that and instantly just turned into, I'm going to be the hippie. It speaks to all the hippies. It's like he was doing comedy for people's parents and then saw this culture war that was going on with those people's kids in the streets and said, I want to be doing comedy for those people, not their parents. And that's what he did. And that's when he sort of became the George Carlin that we know and love. And then he had this whole kind of second part of his career where it's like he sort of like he became popular for a lot of the stuff that he was doing, but then started to fall into a rut and was just kind of like going in circles and repeating himself a lot and became stale. And, you know, he became a bit of a punchline in and of himself. There's a part where like Cheech Marin publicly announces that George Carlin is obsolete. And there became this point where he sort of went away and came back with some harder material. And by harder, I mean politically harder. and started like really taking massive swings at the establishment in a way that only comics like Bill Hicks would do. And that's when I think you get some of Carlin's most powerful stand-up that he's ever done. And you're seeing this old guy basically come back in and just like school everyone. And it's like, it's really interesting. I think he's led a really interesting life, and his career in comedy is really interesting. And the fact that I really like his stand-up, of course, you know, feeds into the whole thing. So I really enjoyed this doc. I think it's definitely a good watch.
Oh, that's good. I'm not very familiar with George Carlin. Dan grew up with a lot of comedy. I did not, so I have a lot of like gaps. And honestly, comedy is, I mean, it's personal to everybody, right? That's things that work for some people don't work for others. But the fact that this is a documentary, I think, is something that's appealing to me, because I like to see sort of like the behind the scenes of, you know, what created, how these people came to be who they are. So that's actually sounds really, really interesting.
A lot of Carlin's comedy has aged particularly well, and you'll see people on social media still constantly sharing his stuff. And the reason is because he locked into this style of comedy of being like incredibly vicious and taking big swings, but he always knew that you need to punch at the institutions, at the establishment, at the sources of power, and not the powerless. So while you have people like Ricky Gervais who are going on Netflix and doing 10 minutes on why all trans people need to be murdered, you'd have George Carlin going up and basically talking about the corporate owners that have bought the politicians, and this is why they're going to take your abortion rights away. And he's right. And he would do some really uncomfortable stuff in a way that was still funny and dark and taking swings at the right things that need to be taken swings at. And that's why George Carlin has endured, and why, you know, people like Ricky Gervais will eventually just be forgotten.
Yeah, pretty much. I have nothing else.
Me either. That's the end of my list, but there's a lot of stuff.
That was, you know, it didn't look like a long list, but it turned out to be a very long list.
Every week when we do this, I put my email together. It's like, okay, here's all the things I'm watching so that, like, you know what I've got on my plate. And I always started off going, God, I don't feel like I've seen that much. This is going to be a really thin week. And then I get to the end of my list. It's like, should I be taking things off? This is a lot of stuff.
Yeah, usually I kind of look and I leave the not so great stuff, the forgettable stuff out. But honestly, I just didn't watch that much stuff the last couple of weeks, so I've been slacking. But it's okay. I feel okay about it.
I mean, if I was going to pull out the forgettable stuff this week, it would have been Firestarter and The Lost City.
I like The Lost City enough to say, yeah, it might be worth a look if you're even vaguely interested, but eh. Yeah. It is what it is.
That's Marina's glowing endorsement of The Lost City. Eh.
Go see Top Gun Maverick instead. That's my endorsement right there. Go see the voice clip instead.
Go see The Fighty Planes.
Yeah, we jokingly said that if there was a job for me on set, it would be a water sprayer. Mm-hmm. Maybe oil sprayer. Maybe it was oil. I don't know. I don't know if... Yeah, I'm assuming it's probably like some oily substance that they spray on everybody to make them look like they're glistening in the sun.
Like they have that sweat. That newly shed sweat.
Yeah, yeah. The best part, really, honestly, the part that really got me about that movie was I was really angry for like 30 seconds when the credits started to roll. I'm like, how did they not thank Tony Scott? And then in memory of Tony Scott, I'm like, okay, you win. We're good. Okay. On that note, where can folks find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch. And there's a couple things I'm going to shout out real quick. First of all is the new season of Ninjago is starting up right away. a show which I have been editing for the last 4 years or so. This season is absolutely enormous, and one of the biggest things I've ever done is really cool. So if you're into Ninjago at all, definitely check that out. The fans right now are losing their fucking minds over this trailers and stuff that we've released. It's great. I've never had anything that I cut before, because I do a lot of trailers, but I've never had anything where it's like people instantly, like the day it drops, there's like 50 people like dissecting the trailer, trying to like analyze it and find stuff. And but I do with Ninjago, and it's very surreal, very weird, but I love it. And the other thing is, I'm not sure when this is dropping, but I imagine it's sometime soon, is I did a guest appearance on the podcast called The Spyhards, to do a roundtable talking about the entirety of the Jason Bourne series. And it was a lot of fun. Those guys are super, super fun. And we did a little entertaining podcast that just talked about the Bourne franchise that I thought was really fun and really entertaining. And I learned something in doing research that I didn't even know, which is, did you know that there is a prequel series that lasted for one season called Treadstone? It's on Prime. I didn't even know this thing existed until I was like going through and doing a rewatch. I was like, wait a minute, there's a show?
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. It is on my very, very long and ever-growing to-be-watched list, but...
I watched one episode of it. It was neat. I don't know if I'm going to finish it or not, but you know, it's there. It exists.
Now that's a glowing recommendation right there. It's there. It exists. We're both on the.
I know the hype is off the chain this week.
Totally off the chain, unless it's Top Gun. Can I mention this movie one more time? Does it need any more help? Probably not.
Well, the real question is, where does it fit on a scale of to it exists?
Oh, it's way higher than either of those. Come on now. It is there and it is awesome. It is awesome. It'll blow your hair back. You know what? I actually, somebody messaged me. They went to a preview screening and they're like, there are so many bald men with mustaches here. Everybody's dad is in this audience. And I'm like, Top Gun, it's not just for dads. I literally had a t-shirt made that I wore to the screening that says, Top Gun, it's not just for dads.
Well, I mean, the movie is making bank right now, which... honestly, like, I would have thought the same thing. It's like, how many people are going to be interested in, like, this 35-year-old movie follow-up? It's going to be a lot of dads. This is, like, going to be the TBS afternoon, this movie. But it's doing really well.
Yeah, and I'm still not sure, like, because our screening was sold out. And I'm still not sure if it was because there were a lot of families. And I'm like, is it the kids taking dad to the movies or is dad dragging the kids to the movies? I'm not 100% sure. And I still don't know what it was. But whatever it is, it's working for them. Great. That's it. Okay, that's enough. All right. That is enough. Okay, you can find Ashley... on Twitter, because it's now been like 10 minutes since we last told people where to find it. And you can find me at the Marina, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks with more amazing discussions that will be a lot of meh. Until then,
insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.